Welcome to today's live talk, and I'm your host, Michelle Gasso. Today we will be speaking with David Hudson, attorney with the First Amendment Center, about prisoners' religious rights. David Hudson Jr. is a research attorney at the First Amendment Center, and he writes for firstamendmentcenter.org and for other publications devoted to First Amendment issues. After working as a judicial law clerk, he joined the First Amendment Center in 1995. He also teaches classes in constitutional law at Middle Tennessee State University and legal research and writing at Nashville School of Law. He is a First Amendment contributing editor for the American Bar Association's preview of the United States Supreme Court cases. His articles have been published in the National Law Journal, the ABA Journal, and the Tennessee Bar Journal, and he's also a member of the First Amendment Lawyers Association. He's also authored several books, including the Bill of Rights, the First 10 Amendments of the Constitution, and several others, and is currently working on one on the Supreme Court. He graduated from Duke University in 1990 and obtained a law degree from Vanderbilt University Law School in 1994. Today he's with us, as I said, to discuss prisoners' rights to religious freedom, and we welcome you, Mr. Hudson, to our live talk.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming today. Can you tell us, just to start, where corrections agencies stand in terms of the requirements that they have to meet to provide religious accommodation?
Right. The general rule now, or the federal law that prison officials have to follow, is a law that was passed in 2000 called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. It's often referred to by its acronym RLUIPA. And that law basically is a result of interplay between the U.S. Supreme Court and Congress. For many years prior to 1990, the United States Supreme Court had given very strong protection to free exercise of religion rights and held that before the government could burden individuals' free exercise rights, they had to, before they could do that, they had to advance a compelling governmental interest, and they had to do that. They had to do so in the least restrictive way possible. Well, what happened was that the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 1990 case, changed all that and said that as long as a law was generally applicable and did not target religious beliefs or religious faith, then it was only subject to basically a reasonableness test. It was not subject to to what we refer to in law as the strict scrutiny analysis. What happened then was that Congress entered the fray and passed a law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993, which in essence basically overruled the court's 1990 decision and said that before government officials can infringe on religious liberty rights, they have to advance a compelling governmental interest in the least restrictive way possible. In a 1997 case, the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated RFRA, that 1993 federal law, as it applied to state and local governments. So Congress again goes back to the drawing board and they pass another law, which is RLUIPA. So basically you had a Supreme Court decision, then a congressional law, then another Supreme Court decision, and another congressional law. And the standard now is the second major federal law called RLUIPA.
Now, in terms of RLUIPA, how much of a role can a prison's sort of security interest or other governmental interest play in refusing to accommodate an inmate's religious request or request to practice a certain type of religion or that sort of thing?
Right. Well, security plays a large role. And in fact, there are many members of the federal judiciary who, despite what RLUIPA says, because RLUIPA does basically to wash away all the highfalutin lingual language. Basically, RLUIPA sets a very high standard before prison officials can infringe on inmates' religious liberty rights.
Okay.
But unfortunately, what happens is a lot of the judges are of the mindset that they should give extreme deference to the beliefs of prison officials. And that's fine to a certain extent, but that can go overboard. And basically what happens in a lot of cases is the court, the prison officials will submit affidavits about how such and such policy, say a grooming policy, advances security interests, and then the courts take that at face value. Now, what happened was in May of this year, there was a case called Cutter versus Wilkinson where the U.S. Supreme Court actually upheld RLUIPA from an Establishment Clause challenge, which is the other part of the religious liberty clauses of the First Amendment, which prohibits or provides for separation of church and state. But even in that opinion, where the court actually upholds the constitutionality of RLUIPA, the court says, quote, that the courts will pay, quote, particular sensitivity to security concerns and be, quote, mindful of the urgency of discipline, order, safety, and security in penal institutions. So in essence, I think from reading a lot of some of the case law at least, I'm not sure that the courts truly apply strict scrutiny, which RLUIPA requires. They often, if safety and security come up, the courts say, well, that's a compelling governmental interest, and then they sort of gloss over the least restrictive means analysis.
Okay. If you're just joining us, we're talking to David Hudson of the First Amendment Center about prisoners' religious rights. We were just referring to a Supreme Court case, that decision earlier this year, but there have been some other cases that the federal courts have ruled on, and as well relating to RLUIPA. Are there, in sort of looking at some of these cases and that have come up, are there certain issues that have been raised, specific issues that officials have said, okay, well, you know, this is a red flag for us. We are not going to grant an accommodation for this, or, you know, there's certain things that particularly bother prison officials.
Well, there are all sorts of challenges. Some of the general ones tend to be inmates seeking religious exemption or seeking a certain religious diet or sacramental observance or an exemption from a grooming policy. They want access to certain religious texts, or perhaps they want to engage in some form of group assembly. And what happens is oftentimes prison officials will be fairly creative in coming up with security interests. They'll say things such as, we should have a grooming policy because if inmates have long hair, they can hide contraband in their hair. Or we should disallow inmates from having certain texts that the inmates say are religious-based, but prison officials say, well, if those texts are passed around, let's say that they might be material that might inflame racial tensions in the prison. Or they'll say things such as, we have to have a grooming policy because otherwise we won't be able to quickly identify inmates, and if inmates are allowed to grow and cut their hair at their own whim, then they might look different than the ID photos. There's even been a case, I ran across a case recently, where they said that inmates, that a prison grooming policy was constitutional and it advanced safety reasons because otherwise, if inmates had long hair, it would raise a safety issue when they use heavy machinery and their hair could get caught in the machinery. So there are a wide array of security rationales that are advanced, and many of them are accepted.
Okay. All right. So it seems like there are some that are and some that aren't, maybe depending on the court you're in or even maybe the circuit you're in.
Absolutely. That's one thing about our system of justice. Sometimes you get justice depending on what judge or what panel of judges you're before.
Are there certain religious accommodations that inmates have requested that the courts have generally protected, though? Are there some that the courts seem to say, okay, well, these don't hamper security?
I think that generally the diet requests tend to be, at least there's a better chance of success on diet as opposed to grooming type issues. I think the group, and there's also a better chance for seeking certain ceremonial religious items as opposed to group assembly.
Okay.
Although there have been a few cases where prisoners have prevailed in grooming policies. But in the bulk of the cases that I've looked at, and there are others that probably have looked at more, have a more systemic analysis of it, but it seems to me in a lot of the cases that the courts tend to side with prison officials, because if they can advance some type of safety or security issue, they seem to get the benefit of the doubt.
Are there any parts of our LUPA that are still kind of out there to remain answered that really the courts, like Supreme Court, hasn't completely dealt with?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the first case that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court was the Cutter v. Wilkinson, and that only addressed the Establishment Clause challenge. And the Establishment Clause, again, is the part that provides a degree of separation between church and state. And the argument was that our LUPA violates the Establishment Clause because it advances religious rights vis-a-vis other rights. So it impermissibly advances religion. The court rejected that. But there are other constitutional challenges to our LUPA that are still percolating in the federal courts, and those include whether it's valid legislation under the spending clause, whether it's valid legislation under the commerce clause, and also whether it might violate states' rights under the 10th Amendment.
Okay.
Now, I believe on remand to the Sixth Circuit in the Cutter case, the court rejected the spending clause challenge. In a lot of cases, our LUPA has been held as constitutional, but there are still some unanswered questions. And then, if you just look at the part of our LUPA deals with land use. The U.S. Supreme Court has not dealt with an our LUPA land use case yet.
Okay.
So that's still to be determined.
So, in some ways, there's some direction on what prison officials should be accommodating, but in many ways, there's still some unanswered questions out there.
Yes, I would say that there's a split of authority actually in the lower courts with respect to some of the grooming policies, and oftentimes it depends actually, at least in the grooming cases, it depends on whether the inmates are classified as minimum security risks or maximum security risks. So it often depends upon the classification of the inmate.
Interesting. Well, that concludes today's live talk, and thank you to David Hudson for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And also thank you to our audience for tuning in. For more information on religious freedom rights for offenders, be sure to read this week's articles on the Corrections Connection at www.corrections.com. For CCNN, I'm Michelle Gasso.